Scholastic Audio presents The False Prince, Book 1 of the Ascendance Trilogy, by Jennifer A. Nielsen, read by Charlie McWade. 1. If I had to do it all over again, I would not have chosen this life. Then again, I'm not sure I ever had a choice. These were my thoughts as I raced away from the market, with a stolen roast tucked under my arm. I'd never attempted roast thievery before, and I was already regretting it. It happens to be very difficult to hold a chunk of raw meat while running, more slippery than I'd anticipated. If the butcher didn't catch me with his cleaver first, and literally cut off my future plans, I vowed to remember to get the meat wrapped next time, then steal it. He was only a few paces behind now, chasing me at a better speed than I'd have expected for a man of his girth. He yelled very loudly in his native language, one I didn't recognize. He was originally from one of the far western countries, undoubtedly a country where killing a meat thief was allowed. It was this sort of thought that encouraged me to run faster. I rounded a corner just as the cleaver suddenly cut into a wood post behind me. Even though he was aiming for me, I couldn't help but admire his throwing accuracy. If I hadn't turned when I did, the cleaver would have found its target, but I was only a block from Mrs. Turbledy's orphanage for disadvantaged boys. I knew how to disappear there. And I might have made it, if not for the bald man sitting outside the tavern, who stretched out his foot in time to trip me. Luckily, I managed to keep hold of the roast, although it did no favors to my right shoulder as I fell onto the hard dirt road. The butcher leaned over me and laughed.
About time you get what's coming to you, filthy beggar.
As a point of fact, I hadn't begged for anything. It was beneath me. His laughter was quickly followed up with a kick to my back that chased my breath away. I curled into a ball, prepared for a beating I wasn't sure I'd live to regret. The butcher landed a second kick and had reared back for a third when another man shouted,
Stop!
The butcher turned.
You stay out of this. He stole a roast.
An entire roast? Really? And what is the cost?
30 garlands.
My well-trained ears heard the sound of coins in a bag. Then the man said, I'll pay you 50 garlands if you turn that boy over to me now.
50? One moment.
The butcher gave me a final kick in the side, then leaned low toward me.
If you ever come into my shop again, I'll cut you up and sell you as meat at the market. Got it?
The message was straightforward. I nodded. The man paid the butcher, who stomped away. I wanted to look up at whoever had saved me further beating, but I was hunched in the only position that didn't send me gasping in pain, and I was in no hurry to change that. The pity I felt for myself wasn't shared by the man with the coins. He grabbed my shirt and yanked me to my feet. Our eyes locked as he lifted me. His were dark brown and more tightly focused than I'd ever seen before. He smiled slightly as he studied me, his thin mouth barely visible behind a neatly trimmed brown beard. He looked to be somewhere in his 40s and dressed in the fine clothes of the upper class, but based on the way he'd lifted me, he was much stronger than I expected of a nobleman.
I'll have a word with you, boy, he said. You'll walk with me to the orphanage, or I'll have you carried there.
The entire right side of my body throbbed, but the left side was okay, so I favored it as I started to walk.
Stand up straight,
the man ordered. I ignored him. He was probably some rich country gentleman who wanted to purchase an indentured servant for his lands. Although I was eager to leave behind the tough streets of Karchar, servitude wasn't in my future plans, which meant I could walk as crookedly as I wanted. Besides, my right leg really hurt. Mrs. Turbledy's orphanage for disadvantaged boys was the only place for orphaned boys in the northern end of Carthia. 19 of us lived there, ranging in age from 3 to 15. I was almost 15, and any day now Mrs. Turbledy would send me away. But I didn't want to leave yet, and certainly not as this stranger's servant boy. Mrs. Turbledy was waiting in her office when I walked in, with the man close behind me. She was too fat to credibly claim she starved along with the rest of us,
but strong enough to beat anyone who complained about that fact. In recent months, she and I had settled into a routine of barely tolerating each other. Mrs. Turbledy must have seen what happened outside, because she shook her head and said,
"Aroused? What were you thinking?"
"That we had a lot of hungry boys," I said. "You can't feed us bean bread every day and not have a revolt."
"You'll give me that roast then,"
she said, holding out her plump hands. "Business first." I clutched the roast more tightly to myself and nodded at the man.
"Who's he?"
The man stepped forward. "My name is Bevan Connor. Tell me yours." I stared at him without answering, which earned me a whack on the back of the head from Mrs. Turbledy's broom.
"His name is Sage," she told Connor. "And as I told you before, you'd be better off with a rabid badger than this one."
Connor raised an eyebrow and stared at me as if that amused him, which was annoying because I had no interest in providing him with any entertainment. So I tossed my hair out of my eyes and said, "She's right. So, can I go now?" Connor frowned and shook his head. The moment of amusement had passed. "What can you do, boy? If you bother to ask my name, you might use it." He continued as if he hadn't heard me. Also annoying. "What's your training?"
"I don't have any," Mrs. Turbledy said. "None a gentleman like yourself would need anyhow."
"What did your father do?" Connor asked me.
"He was best as a musician, but still a terrible one," I said. "If he made a single coin from playing, my family never saw it."
"He was probably a drunk,"
Mrs. Turbledy rapped my ear with her knuckles.
"So this one's made his way through theft and lies."
"What sort of lies?"
I wasn't sure if the question was directed to me or Mrs. Turbledy, but he was looking at Mrs. Turbledy, so I let her speak. She took Connor by the arm and pulled him into a corner, which was an entirely useless gesture because not only was I standing right there and perfectly able to hear every word, but the story was also about me, so it was hardly a secret. Connor obliged her, though I noticed he faced himself toward me as she spoke.
"First time the boy came in here, he had a shiny silver coin in his hand. Said he was a runaway, the son of a dead duke from somewhere in Avignia. Only he didn't want to be a duke. So if I took him in and gave him preferential care and a place to hide, he paid me a coin a week. Kept it up for 2 weeks, all the time laughing it up on extra servings at dinner and with extra blankets on his bed."
Connor glanced at me and I rolled my eyes. He'd be less impressed when she finished the story.
"Then one night, he took with a fever. Got all delirious late in the night, hitting at everyone and yelling and such. I was there when he confessed it all. He's no son of anyone important. The coins belonged to a duke, all right, but he'd stolen them to trick me into caring for him. I dumped his body into the cellar to get better or not. I didn't care. Next time I checked on him, he got over the fever on his own and was a good deal more humble."
Connor looked at me again.
"He doesn't look so humble now."
"I got over that, too," I said.
"So why'd you let him stay?"
Connor asked Mrs. Turbledy. Mrs. Turbledy hesitated. She didn't want to tell him it was because I picked up goodies for her now and then. Ribbon for her hats or chocolates from the cake shop. Because of that, Mrs. Turbledy didn't hate me nearly as much as she pretended to. Or maybe she did. I stole from her, too. Connor walked back to me.
"A thief and a liar, eh? Can you manage a sword?"
"Sure, if my opponent doesn't have one." He grinned.
"Do you farm?"
"No." I took that as an insult.
"Hunt?"
"No."
"Can you read?"
I stared up at him through the parts of my hair. "What are you wanting me for, Connor?"
"You'll address me as Sir or Master Connor."
"What are you wanting me for, Sir Master Connor?"
"That's a conversation for another time. Gather your things, I'll wait for you here."
I shook my head. "Sorry, but when I leave the comfort of Mrs. Turbledy's fine establishment, I go on my own."
"You're going with him,"
Mrs. Turbledy said.
"You've been bought and paid for by Master Connor, and I can't wait to be rid of you."
"You'll earn your freedom by doing whatever I ask of you and doing it well,"
Connor added.
"Or serve me poorly and serve me for life."
I wouldn't serve anyone for an hour until freedom, I said. Connor took a step toward me, hands out. I threw the roast I'd been holding at him and he flinched to avoid it. Using that moment, I pushed past Mrs. Turbledy and darted into the street. It would have been helpful to know that he'd left a couple of vigils at the door. One grabbed my arms while the other clubbed me over the head from behind. I barely had time to curse their mother's graves before I crumpled to the ground. 2. I awoke with my hands tied behind my back and lying in the bed of a wagon. A throbbing headache pulsed inside me, worsened by the jostling of the wagon as we rode. The least Connor could have done was give me something soft to lie on. I resisted the temptation to open my eyes until my situation became clearer. My wrists were tied behind my back with a coarse rope, one that might be used to lead a horse. If it was, then I wondered if the rope was a last-minute idea. Maybe Connor hadn't expected to be taking me by force. Connor should have come more prepared. This thick rope worked to my advantage. It was easier to loosen the knots. Someone coughed near me. Didn't sound like Connor. Maybe it was one of his thug vigils. As slowly as possible, I inched one eye open. The cool spring day had become a bit overcast, but wasn't yet threatening rain. Too bad. I could have used a bath. One of Connor's vigils was at the far end of the wagon, looking at the view behind us. That probably meant Connor and the other vigils were on the seat at the front of the wagon. Another cough to my left. I let my head bounce with the next jolt of the wagon to see where it had come from. Two boys sat there. The shorter one closest to me seemed to be doing the coughing. Both were near my age. The coughing boy looked sickly and pale, while the other was larger and tanned. They each had light brown hair, though the coughing boy's hair was nearer to blonde. He had rounder features as well. I suspected wherever he came from, he'd spent more time sick in bed than at work, and just the opposite for the other boy. I judged myself to be a blend of the two. Nothing about me was remarkable. I was only of medium height, one of many ways I disappointed my father, who had felt that it would hinder my success. I disagreed. Tall people fit in fewer hiding places. My hair was badly in need of cutting, tangled and dark blonde but getting lighter with each passing month. And I had a forgettable face, which again worked in my favor. The boy coughed again, and I opened both eyes to determine if he was sick or had something to say and was clearing his throat to get our attention. Only he caught me looking at him. Our eyes focused so solidly on each other that it was pointless to pretend I was still asleep, at least to him. Would he give up my secret? I hoped not. I needed time to think, and time for some unfortunately placed bruises to heal. Time was not on my side.
He's awake.
That was the larger boy, who got the attention of Connor's backseat vigil. The vigil crawled across the wagon to slap my cheek, which wasn't necessary because my eyes were mostly open. I swore at him, then winced as he yanked me into a sitting position.
Not too rough, Connor called from his seat. He's a guest, Cregan.
The vigil, now known as Cregan, glared at me. I didn't say anything else. Figuring the phrase I just used to curse at him had satisfactorily explained my wishes for the cause of his death.
You've met Cregan, Connor said, then added, Mott is our driver.
Mott glanced back to nod a hello at me. He and Cregan couldn't have been designed to look more different from each other. Mott was tall, dark-skinned, and nearly bald. What little hair he did have was black and shaved to his scalp. He was the one by the tavern who'd tripped me when I was trying to escape the butcher. In contrast, Cregan was short, not much taller than I was, and shorter than the tanned boy near me. He was surprisingly pale for a man who likely spent much of his day outdoors, and he had a thick crop of blonde hair that he tied back at the nape of his neck. Mott was lean and muscular, while Cregan looked softer than I knew him to be, judging by the way he clubbed me at the orphanage. How strange that there could be two people so different from each other, and yet my dislike for them was equally fierce. Connor motioned to the boys in the wagon with me.
That's Latimer and Roden.
Latimer was the coffer. Roden had ratted me out for being awake. They nodded at me. Then Latimer shrugged, as if to say he had no more of an idea why we were here than I did.
I'm hungry,
I said.
I'd planned on having roast for dinner, so whatever you've got had better be good.
Connor laughed and tossed an apple onto my lap, which sat there because my hands were still tied behind me. Roden reached over, snatched the apple, and took a big bite of it.
One of the rewards for not having fought coming along. I'm not tied up like a prisoner.
That was mine, I said.
The apple was for anyone willing to take it,
Connor said. There was silence for another moment, except for the sound of Roden eating. I stared icily at him, though I knew it'd do no good. If he came from an orphanage as I did, he knew the rules of survival. Rule number one said you took food whenever it was available, as much as you could get. Neither of you fought Connor? I asked Latimer and Roden. Latimer shook his head and coughed. He probably didn't have the strength to fight. Roden leaned forward and wrapped his arms around his legs.
I saw the orphanage you came from. It was 10 times the place I lived in. Then Connor comes and says if I cooperate, I could get a big reward. So no, I didn't fight.
You might have given me that nice speech instead of having me hit over the head, I told Connor. What's the reward?
Connor didn't turn around to answer.
Cooperate first, then we'll talk reward.
Roden tossed his apple core from the cart. He didn't even have the decency to eat all of it.
You can untie me now,
I said. It probably wasn't going to be that easy, but there was no harm in asking. Connor answered.
Mrs. Turbledy warned me that you have a history of running away. Where do you go?
The church, of course, to confess my sins.
Roden snorted a laugh, but Connor didn't seem to find the same humor.
I can starve that blasphemy out of you, boy.
I leaned my head back and closed my eyes, hoping to end any conversation involving me. For the most part, it worked. Roden said something about his devotion to the church, but I let it go. None of it mattered. I didn't plan on being here much longer. About an hour later, the wagon stopped in a small town I'd been to once before. It was named Gelvins. Although as small as it was, I'm not sure it deserved any name. Gelvins was more like an outpost than a town. With only a few shops on the street and a dozen pathetic excuses for homes. Carthian homes were normally well-built and sturdy, but Gelvins was poor and its farms dry. A sturdy home was a luxury few here could dream of, much less afford to build. Most of these thin wooden structures looked like they would be finished in a stiff windstorm. Our wagon had stopped in front of a shack with a small sign over the doorway identifying it as the Gelvins Charity Orphanage. I knew this place. I'd stayed here several months ago after Mrs. Turbledy temporarily kicked me out. Connor took Mott with him and left Cregan to guard us. As soon as Connor left, Cregan jumped out of the wagon and said he was going to get a quick drink in the tavern and that he'd personally kill any boy who tried to escape.
Another orphan? Roden asked. Connor's probably been to every orphanage in the country. What could he possibly want with all of us?
You don't know? I asked. Latimer shrugged, but Roden said,
He's looking for one particular boy, but I don't know why. He won't want me.
Latimer's voice was so quiet the snorting of our horses nearly drowned him out.
I'm sick.
Maybe he will, I said. We don't know what he wants.
I plan on being whatever he wants, Roden said. I'm not going back to any orphanage, and I've got no future on the streets.
Who is Bevan Connor? I asked. Do either of you know anything about him?
I overheard him speaking to Master Grippings, who runs the orphanage where Roden and I lived,
Latimer mumbled.
He said he was a friend of the king's court.
King Ecbert? I shook my head. Connor's lying, then. Everyone knows the king has no friends. Latimer shrugged.
Friend or enemy, he convinced Master Grippings that he was here as a service to the king.
But what does that have to do with us? I asked. A handful of orphaned boys.
He just wants one boy, Rodin reminded us. The rest of us will be cast away as soon as we become useless to Connor. He said as much to Master Grippings.
Let me make it easier on you, I said to Rodin. Untie me and I'll be on my way. That's one less boy to contend with.
I'll do no such thing, Rodin said. Do you think I want to be punished for your escape?
Fine, but the knots are really tight. Could you just loosen them?
Rodin shook his head. If they're tight, it's because you irritated Connor's vigils, and you probably deserve it.
Connor wouldn't want him to be hurt, Latimer crept toward me and said.
Turn around.
I can't maneuver with my arms behind me. Just reach back there.
Latimer stretched an arm across my back, which I caught with my hand and twisted behind him. Rodin jumped up to one knee, startled, but with my other hand I slipped a noose over Latimer's neck and pulled it so that it was nearly tightened. Rodin froze, waiting to see what I'd do next. Getting the rope off my wrists had been an easy matter. Knotting it into a noose was a bit trickier, although now was not the time to admire my handiwork. Rodin didn't look impressed with my behind-the-back knot tying. Clearly, he'd never attempted something like that before, or he would have been. Or maybe he just didn't want me to strangle Latimer in front of him.
Not an inch closer to me, I warned Rodin. Or else I'll dump him over the side of the cart, and you can describe to Connor the sound of his snapping neck.
Please don't do that, Latimer breathed. Rodin sat back down. I don't care if you kill him, and I don't care if you run away. Leave if you want, and pray Connor's vigils don't find you.
I stood, apologized to Latimer for threatening to kill him, then gave a ceremonial bow to Rodin. The bow might have been a mistake. Midway through standing up straight, Cregan whacked me in the back with the flat end of his sword. I fell forward, all air knocked from my lungs.
You know what'd happen to me if I let you get away, boy,
Cregan snarled. I knew, and I wasn't entirely opposed to it.
You said you'd kill anyone who tried to escape,
Rodin reminded him.
And so I will,
Cregan said, baring his teeth when I turned to look at him. He'd replaced his sword with a knife and leapt into the wagon in two steps. I rolled over to make a run for it, but he grabbed my shirt, shoved me back down, and pressed the knife to my throat.
Master Connor doesn't need all of you, and I think he needs you least of all.
Suddenly, I had a motivation to be needed by Master Connor.
Okay, I grumbled. You win. I'll cooperate.
You're lying,
Cregan said. I often lie, but not about this. I'll cooperate. Cregan smiled, pleased to have humiliated me. He replaced his knife in the sheath at his waist, then yanked me up by my collar and tossed me into the corner of the wagon.
We'll see.
A minute later, Connor returned to the wagon with Mott and a boy walking beside him. I squinted, certain I recognized him. He was tall and unusually thin. His hair was darker than both mine and Rodin's, but his was stringy and straight, and more in need of a trim than mine, if that was possible. The boy climbed dutifully into the back of the wagon. Connor glanced at my untied hands, and then at the thin vein of blood trickling down my neck. He eyed Cregan.
Any trouble?
None, sir, Cregan responded. Only I believe you'll find Sage to be more cooperative now.
Connor smiled as if that was all he needed to know of the matter.
I'm glad to hear it. Boys, meet Tobias. He'll be joining us in our quest.
What quest? I asked. Connor shook his head.
Patience, Sage. Patience is the mark of a ruler.
And that was my first clue about why Connor had taken us. We were all in terrible danger. 3. I knew Tobias. He might not have known me because I'd come and gone from Gelvin's charity orphanage so quickly. But in my short stay, Tobias had stood out amongst the others. He was no ordinary orphan. He'd been educated as a child and continued to read anything he could get his hands on. He was given special privileges at the orphanage because it was felt he was one of the few with any hopes of one day making a success of his life. Tobias glanced my way.
You're
bleeding. I brushed at the cut mark on my neck. It's mostly stopped. That was as much concern as he wished to invest. Do I know you? I stayed here about 6 months ago. Yeah, I remember. Locked a headmaster out of the orphanage for an entire night, didn't you? The grin on my face became my confession. You have to admit, we ate well that night, for once. It's not funny, Tobias scolded. Maybe we don't eat well most of the time, but it's because there's not a lot of food to go around. You gave out a week's worth of food that night. It was a very long, very hungry week after you left. My grin faded. I hadn't known that. We rode for over an hour through a lonely plain covered in gorse and nettle. Tobias remarked that he found it beautiful in a desolate sort of way. I saw the desolation, but the beauty escaped me. Eventually it became dark enough that Mott suggested we find a place to stop for the night. The closest town was still Galvin's behind us, rather than anything yet ahead, so I didn't think it should matter too much where we camped. But Mott still took us a ways farther until the vegetation changed, and he found a small clearing surrounded by tall willow trees and thick bushes. They're hiding us, I muttered to the other boys. Rodin shook his head back at me and said, It's safer here than out in the open. They're protecting us. Mott jumped off the wagon and began shouting orders at each of us for what to unload from the wagons and where to put it. Mostly blankets, and I hoped food. I was assigned to remain in the wagon and hand things to the others on the ground. Afraid I'll run away? I asked.
Any trust you get here will have to be earned, Mott said. And I'd say you have a great deal more to earn than the others.
He nodded at a sack near my foot.
Hand me that.
Although Connor was the master of our group, Mott was clearly the one keeping our show running. He was no ordinary useless vigil. At least I noticed that he didn't need to ask Connor's permission for everything. And when Mott issued orders to Cregan, Cregan did as he was told. While we worked, Connor stationed himself on a fallen log to peruse a tattered leather-bound book. Every now and then he'd glance up, studying each of us with more than a casual examination, then return to his book. Cregan got a fire going. And afterward, Mott instructed us to gather around so that Connor could talk to us.
Talk to us? I said. When do we eat?
We eat after the talk,
Connor said, closing his book and standing.
Come, boys, sit.
I jumped out of the wagon and squeezed onto the edge of a log Rodin and Tobias had dragged near the fire. They weren't too pleased to have me there, but didn't complain either. Latimer squatted on the ground. I considered offering him my seat since he was still coughing, but I guessed he wouldn't take it anyway. Connor coughed too, although his was the kind meant to get our attention. The cough wasn't necessary. We were already watching him.
I haven't said much as to why I've collected you boys, Connor began. I'm sure in your heads you've created every sort of speculation, from the likely and plausible to the wild and impossible. What I have in mind is closer to the latter of those.
Tobias sat up straighter. I already dislike him as much as Rodin, even though there had been far more time for me to learn to dislike Rodin.
I can't deny there's danger with my plan, Connor said. If we fail, there will be terrible consequences. But if we succeed, the rewards are beyond your imagination.
I wasn't sure about that. I could imagine some fairly big rewards.
In the end, only one of you can be chosen. I need the boy who proves himself to be the closest fit with my plan. And my plan is very demanding and very specific.
Tobias raised his hand, a sign that he'd been educated. At the orphanage I came from, a person only raised a hand if he was about to hit someone with it. Sir, what is your plan?
Excellent question, Tobias, but it's also a very secret plan. So what I'd like to do first is offer any of you the chance to leave now. You may leave with no feelings of regret or cowardice. I've been very upfront about both the danger
and the rewards. If you don't feel that this is for you, then this is your opportunity to leave.
Rodin looked at me. I arched my eyebrows in response. He wanted me to leave, that was clear. And I would have stood right then, except for a nagging voice in my head that told me something was wrong. So I kept still. Latimer raised his hand, not because he'd been trained to, but because it had worked for Tobias.
Sir, I think I'd like to leave. I'm not fit to compete with these other boys. And frankly, I'm not one to face danger, even for great rewards.
Apparently the nagging voice hadn't visited Latimer's head.
Certainly you may leave.
Connor politely raised a hand toward the wagon.
Why don't you get back in there and I'll have Cregan drive you to the nearest town.
Tonight?
The rest of us have more to discuss tonight, so yes, go right now.
Latimer gave an apologetic smile to us and thanked Connor for understanding. I nodded a goodbye to him and wondered, like I'm sure Rodin and Tobias did, if it'd be smart to make the same choice. Connor hadn't said what would happen to the boys he didn't pick for his plan, nor just how dangerous things might get. Then I realized what my instincts had been trying to tell me. Mott was ahead of us, motioning Latimer toward the wagon. Where was Cregan? I stood and yelled, "Latimer, stop!" But my warning only gave Latimer time to turn from climbing into the wagon. His eyes widened as he saw what I had sensed. An arrow whooshed past me and pierced his chest. Latimer yelped like a wounded dog and fell backward on the ground, dead. With a furious cry, I leapt toward Cregan, who is still partially hidden in the shadows behind us, and tackled him to the ground. Cregan went for the knife at his waist, but one hand still held the bow he'd used to kill Latimer, so I got the knife first. With my body crossways over Cregan's, I started to crawl off him, but Mott lunged at me from behind and I collapsed face down into the dirt. Cregan took a deep breath, then sat up and easily wrested the knife from my hand. That was probably a good thing. I don't know what I would have done with it if Mott hadn't stopped me.
You killed him!
I growled, getting a taste of dirt into my mouth. Connor knelt beside me and lowered himself so that I could see his face. His voice was eerily calm.
Latimer was sick, Sage. He wasn't going to get better, and I think he proved a good lesson for the rest of you. Now you can get up and rejoin the other boys, or you can take a wagon ride with Latimer. It's your choice.
I thrust my jaw forward and glared at Connor, then finally said, I suppose Latimer won't be much company now. I'll stay here.
Excellent decision.
Connor clapped a hand on my back as if we were old friends. He nodded at Mott, who let me go, then added,
I'm sure Latimer's death is a shock to you, but it was important for you three to understand the seriousness of what we are doing.
When I sat up, Cregan's leg brushed roughly past me as he went to help lift Latimer's body into the wagon. Normally, I'd have kicked him in return, but for the moment I was too stunned to think.
Bury him deep, Connor said.
Still on the log, Tobias was pale and perfectly still. Rodin looked as if he was having trouble breathing. My breathing wasn't working any better. It didn't help that Mott had rudely pressed his knee into my back for the last couple of minutes. Connor's smile was a thin line on his face.
Sage, I believe your question earlier was why we had the meeting before we ate. This is why. So we wouldn't waste our food.
His eyes passed over to Rodin and Tobias.
How about it, then? Does anybody else want to leave?
4. Mott laid out a sack of fresh fruit and salted meat, but other than him and Connor, none of us touched it.
It's your last chance until breakfast, Connor said. You'll want to keep your strength up.
Rodin shook his head at Connor. He didn't look like he could stomach a bite of food anyway. Tobias had been nearly frozen since Latimer was killed. He'd barely even blinked. I'd gone numb. Literally, I felt nothing. Connor and Mott ate their meal while the rest of us sat. Slowly, the shock wore off and we began to accept that as long as we did what we were told, we'd live to see another morning.
Connor offered the food to us again.
We have more traveling ahead of us, so you'll only hurt yourselves if you don't eat.
Rodin reached for the food first. He handed it to me and then Tobias. The piece of meat I took was unbearably salty and forced me into taking an apple, even though I had no appetite for it. I don't think Tobias or Rodin enjoyed their food much either. A wave of nausea threatened me every time I looked in the direction where Latimer had fallen. At the orphanage, we'd all seen our share of violence and brutality. I once saw an older boy start kicking a younger one just for rolling over onto his mattress. It took five of us to stop him. But Connor had told Latimer it would be safe to leave. He baited Latimer to teach us a lesson about leaving. The knowledge that Latimer had been brought along only for that purpose consumed my thoughts. If I'd figured out what was happening even a few seconds earlier, could I have stopped it? Were any of the rest of us here as no more than a lesson to the others?
Now that you've eaten, we can continue our conversation.
Connor nodded at Tobias.
Stand up. I wish to get a general understanding of who each of you is.
Tobias stood stiffly. His knees were rigid and he looked like he was about to be sick.
Tobias, you and an opponent are engaged in a sword battle. It's meant to be a battle to the death, but it's also clear that he's better than you are. Do you fight on, knowing you'll likely die, or stop the battle and beg for your opponent's mercy?
I beg mercy, Tobias said. If it's clear I won't win, then nothing is accomplished through my death. I'd hope to live and make myself stronger for the next battle. Connor nodded at Rodin.
What about you?
Rodin stood.
Fight to the death, even if it's my own. I'm a good fighter, sir, and I will not live as a coward.
Tobias flinched at that, but he said nothing. A slight smile crossed Rodin's face. He knew he'd taken an edge with his answer.
Have you been trained with a sword? Connor asked.
Rodin shrugged.
An old Carthian soldier lives near my orphanage. He used to have me do rounds with him, to keep up his skills.
Did you ever win?
No, but...
Then you haven't been trained.
Connor turned to me.
Sage?
Beg mercy? Rodin snorted. I continued. Then, when my opponent lowers his guard, certain of his victory, I'd finish the battle. Connor laughed.
A violation of all sportsmanship and swordplay, Tobias said.
What do I care about sportsmanship? I said. If I'm about to get killed, it's not play anymore. I won't check the rules to see if my survival fits with someone's codebook of fair play.
You'd never win that way, Rodin said. Any master swordsman won't lower his guard until you're disarmed.
Connor didn't say he was a master swordsman, I said. Only that he was better than me. And yes, I would win. Connor walked closer to me.
Stand when I address you.
I obeyed. Connor was taller than me by several inches and stood closer than I liked. But I refused to step back. It occurred to me that he was testing to see whether I would.
Are you standing straight?
Connor asked.
You slouch so much I might mistake you for a hunchback. And with all that hair in your face, you might be a criminal too.
I straightened but made no attempt to push the hair out of my eyes. I could see him just fine, which was all I cared about. Connor asked,
Who do you look like? Your mother or father?
It's hard to say, sir. It's been a long time since I've seen myself in a mirror.
You have a clever tongue and an arrogant tilt to your head. I'm surprised Mrs. Turbledy hasn't beaten it out of you.
You mustn't blame her. She beat me the best she could.
You're a trick to figure out, Sage. Would you ever be on my side, even if I chose you above the other boys?
I'm only on my side. Your trick will be convincing me that helping you helps me.
What if I did?
Connor asked.
How far would you go to win?
The better question, sir, is how far you will go to win. I looked him steadily in the eyes as I spoke, although his back was to the fire and his eyes were set in shadow. You killed Latimer, so we know you're willing to murder to win.
I am.
Connor backed up, speaking to all of us again.
And I'm willing to lie, to cheat, and to steal.
I'm willing to commend my soul to the devils if necessary because I believe there is exoneration in my cause. I need one of you to conduct the greatest fraud ever perpetrated within the country of Carthia. This is a lifetime commitment. It will never be safe to back down from my plan and tell the truth. To do so would destroy not only you, but the entire country. And you will do it to save Carthia.
To save Carthia? Tobias asked. How?
Later. Later, Connor said. Until then, boys, Mott has laid out a blanket for each of you by the fire. Tonight we sleep, and sleep well, because tomorrow our work will begin.
I chose the blanket closest to me. Rodin lay near me and wrapped his blanket tightly around him.
Remember when I said I never won rounds against that old soldier?
He asked. Without waiting for an answer, Rodin added,
It's because I knew he'd stop if I won. I'm good with a sword.
Maybe you can use some of those skills to get us out of here, I mumbled.
You saw what he did to Latimer.
Rodin was silent for several minutes, then whispered,
They just killed him. Told him he was safe to go. Then they killed him. What is Connor planning that would make him willing to kill?
He's planning a revolution, I whispered back. Connor is going to use one of us to overthrow the kingdom.
5. Sometime during the night, I tried to roll over in my blanket. A tug on my ankle awoke me and I sat up to find myself chained to Mott, who was sleeping beside me. I grabbed a pebble and flung it at Mott's face. His eyes flew open and he sat up, glaring at me.
What?
He snarled.
You chained me up?
I said.
Not the others, only me?
The others won't run. You might.
Mott lay back down.
Go to sleep or I'll knock you out cold.
I've got to go.
Go where?
To go.
I'd have just taken care of it myself, but it looks like you want to come along. Mott cursed.
Wait for morning.
Wish I could. I've been cursed with my mother's pea-sized bladder. Mott sat up again, fumbled on the ground for the keys to the chain, then unlocked himself. He grabbed his sword and directed me to stand, then escorted me over the cold ground to some bushes a little ways from camp.
Go here.
I did my business, then we walked back to camp. Mott grabbed the collar of my shirt and shoved me back onto my blanket.
You ever wake me in the night again and I'll hurt you.
As long as you have me chained, prepare for waking up a lot in the night, I said. I'm not a quiet sleeper. He replaced the chain, tightening it, I noticed, from what it had been before. I stretched and yawned and rolled over, pulling my chained leg as far forward as I could. Mott yanked it back. Even though I knew I'd pay for it the next day, I couldn't help but grin as I pulled my leg forward again. Surprisingly, that morning Mott made no mention of the previous night. I got a kick awake, but so did Rodin. Tobias was up walking around, so he must have been awake already, and smirked a little to see Rodin and me groan in our blankets. Rodin seemed to have recovered from the shock of Latimer's murder last night, or at least, he was back to his old self, assuring Tobias and me as we cleaned up that he intended to be the boy Connor chose. Tobias and I glanced at each other. Tobias's expression was clear. He intended to win too, only he clearly planned on pursuing that goal more quietly than Rodin.
I have bread for breakfast, Connor announced. A mouthful for any boy who correctly answers my questions.
He broke off a piece of bread and asked,
Who are the current king and queen of Carthia?
Ecgbert and Corinne, I said quickly. Tobias laughed. King Ecgbert is correct, but the queen is Erin. Connor tossed the bread to Tobias, which I thought was unfair. I'd already given him half the answer, yet he got the entire bite. Connor broke off another piece, then asked,
How many regents sit in King Ecgbert's court?
Tobias guessed 10, but Connor said that was incorrect. Neither Rodin nor I answered.
The correct answer is 20,
Connor said. No matter how many nobles or wealth or stature exist in the land, there are always 20 regents given a seat in the court. They advise the king, although Ecbert too often ignores his regents. He popped the bread in his mouth and took another piece while he chewed. After swallowing, he asked, "How many sons does King Ecbert have?" "Two," I answered. "Wrong again," Tobias said. "There is one, the Crown Prince Darius. There were two until 4 years ago when the younger son, Prince Jaren, was lost during a sea voyage." Connor tossed the bread to Tobias and then said to me,
"Your accent is Avenian, so you're not originally from Carthia. What brought you from Avenia to Carthia?"
"That orphanage was the farthest away I could get from my family," I said.
"Are your parents still alive?"
he asked. "I have not sought out any information on them for some time," I said. "As far as I know, I'm completely alone in this world."
"Avenia is a violent country," Connor said. "If disease doesn't strike, bandits will. Few live to old age in Avenia."
"Consider me an orphan," I said, "an orphan of family and of country. Is loyalty to Carthia a requirement for you?" Connor nodded.
"It's a must. It will take you more effort to learn facts about this country, which Rodin and Tobias have grown up knowing. Are you up to learning?"
I shrugged. "Tell me about the regents." Connor rewarded my question with a chunk of bread, and then said,
"I am one of the 20 regents, albeit a minor one. My father was a man of great influence in the court, so upon his recent death I inherited my position in the court. 13 of the regents inherited their positions. The other 7 earned them through great acts of service to the king. 3 of the regents are women. 2 are old men whose sons can't wait for them to die to take their places. For every regent in the court, there are 5 nobles in Carthia who would love to see them fall from grace, so that another Carthian can be brought into council with the king. All of the regents claim loyalty to the king, but few actually practice it. The secret none of them keep very well is that they wish to have the throne for themselves."
"Does that include you?" Rodin's question was not rewarded with bread. Connor pressed his lips together and then said,
"As I told you, my status in the court is minor. It's useless for me to aspire to the throne. It would be taken over 100 times before I attained enough power to acquire it."
"He didn't ask whether you'd get the throne," I said. "He asked whether you wanted it." Connor smiled.
"Is there anyone who bows to the throne and does not wish that he was the one who sat on it? Tell me, Sage, have you ever lain on the hard floor of the orphanage, staring at the stars through cracks in the ceiling, and wondered what it would be like to be king?"
I couldn't deny that. Beside me, Rodin and Tobias were nodding their heads. In the few moments at night before sleep came upon us, when all orphans do their best dreaming, we'd all thought about it. Connor continued his lesson.
"Second in power to the king is the High Chamberlain, Lord Curwyn. But Curwyn is a servant to the king and could not become king himself. The most powerful of the regents is the Prime Regent, a man named Santhias Veldegrath. He's ruthless in his ambition. He's climbed the ladder of power by destroying those with influence greater than his. I suspect there are more than 12 nobles, either dead or in the king's prison, because of Veldegrath. He wants the crown and works the king's armies to his favor. If anything were ever to happen to the royal family, Veldegrath would be the first to reach for the throne. The other regents would either bow to his will or send Carthia into civil war in pursuit of their own ambitions."
"I know of Veldegrath," Tobias said. "He owned the land my grandmother lived on. One day a messenger came round and told her the rent would be doubled. She hated him to the end of her life."
"He has his enemies, yes, but he also has powerful friends. Veldegrath has no compassion for the people and will suck every good thing from Carthia to himself until it's swallowed up."
"So which do you prefer?" Tobias asked. "A reign of Veldegrath or civil war.
Neither. That is why you are here.
Connor tossed the remaining bread to the ground for us to divide amongst ourselves, then brushed his hands together and said to Mott and Cregan,
"Wipe away any trace of our being here as best you can. I wish to leave within the hour."
Rodin and Tobias dove for the bread, but I stayed where I was, watching Connor walk back to the cart. The hints he left for us about his plan were not subtle. It was clear what he wanted, but there was obviously some crucial information he was still leaving out. I didn't dare wonder what that might be. Connor met my gaze as he passed by and stopped walking. He gave me an appraising look as we stood there, then slowly nodded his head before walking on. I closed my eyes, horrified that my suspicions might be true. Connor was holding us on the brink of treason.
6.
Connor lectured us about Carthia for nearly the entire ride to wherever we were going that morning. He faced backward in the wagon seat while Mott drove and Cregan did vigil duty from the rear. He pointed out the various towns all over Carthia, gesturing their direction from us and describing in detail the qualities of the different large cities.
"Triliad is that way," he said, pointing to the south, "the capital of Carthia and home of the royal family. Have any of you ever been there?"
Tobias spoke up. "My father brought me there when I was very young, but I don't remember it." "I've been there too, but it was some time ago," I added. "Tried to steal a pigeon from the king's dovecot. It didn't work out so well." They laughed, which was odd since I hadn't meant it as a joke. I'd been hungry at the time and barely escaped without being detected. Sprained my ankle in a fall as I ran that didn't heal for a week. I'd been to many of the towns he spoke of. It was clear that I was better traveled than either Rodin or Tobias. Rodin said he'd been born somewhere in southern Carthia and left on the steps of the orphanage in Benton. He had no idea who his parents were or anything about them. He'd never left Benton until Connor came for him. Tobias said that he had been born in a town near Gelvins, but his mother died at birth and his father died of disease a few years later. His grandmother had taken over his care afterward, but after she died 2 years ago, he'd been sent to the orphanage.
"Who educated you?" Connor asked him.
"My grandmother? She worked for a man who had a vast library and let her borrow a different book each week to read to me. I miss the books almost as much as I miss her."
"Do you read?"
Connor asked Rodin, who shook his head.
"I've always wanted to, though," Rodin said. "I'm good on my feet and thought maybe I'd join the king's army, but to rise in rank, I'd be expected to read."
"So you're a patriot," Connor said admiringly. "Then we shall have to teach you to read. What about you, Sage? Can you read?"
I shrugged. "Didn't you already ask me that?"
"You chose to insult me last time rather than answer," Connor said. "I don't expect you've had much education."
"My father said a person can be educated and still be stupid, and a wise man can have no education at all."
"Your father was a worthless musician," Connor said. "It sounds to me like he was both stupid and without education." "And Mrs. Turbledy told me your mother was a barmaid? I hate to think of the education she might have given you."
I stared at my hands resting on my knees. "If you can give me anything worth reading, I'll make my way through it."
"Who amongst you rides a horse in a gentleman's style?"
Again, none of us answered. I'd ridden a horse several times before, but in all my recent experience, it was usually stolen and always in an attempt to escape the horse's owner. That probably wasn't a gentleman's style.
"I hardly dare ask whether any of you have been taught your manners and other social graces."
"I have, a little," Tobias said.
Rodin actually laughed at Connor's question, though he quickly corrected himself.
"Master Connor, make me into a gentleman. I'll learn."
"You will all learn," Connor said. "And at the end of the next 2 weeks, I intend to make each of you into a gentleman, so flawless in your learning, you could pass as a noble before the king himself."
"We're going to see the king?"
I asked.
Connor shook his head.
I didn't say that. Only that you could stand in front of him and make him believe you are a noble.
Rodin looked over at me and smiled. I didn't share his enthusiasm.
2 weeks? I asked. What's the hurry?
Connor locked eyes with me.
Because that's when the boy I choose will be tested.
Tobias cleared his throat and then asked,
What happens to the other two boys, sir?
The two boys who you don't choose? Connor looked at each one of us before answering. When he spoke, he only said,
2 weeks, boys. Pray you are the one I choose.
Then he turned his back to us, and we continued riding. Tobias, Rodin, and I looked at one another. Cregan read the unspoken conversation and chuckled. Rodin seemed a little more pale again. Tobias lost any expression on his face whatsoever, as if he'd turned to stone. Undoubtedly, we were all remembering how casually Connor had ordered Latimer's death, and then had quickly justified it based on the higher moral status of his plan. He would choose his winner in 2 weeks, and most likely the other two boys would follow Latimer's fate at the same time.
7. It was late afternoon when our wagon pulled up to a large estate several miles outside the town of Tithio. An engraved wooden sign at the entrance identified this as Connor's home. It rose 2 stories above the ground with a partial third floor arching over the center of the house. The roof was nearly flat and bordered by a low parapet. I wondered if any stairways led up to the rooftop for what was certain to be an impressive view of Connor's extensive grounds. The building was made of thick tan bricks and cut stone. This alone was impressive, since it didn't look like there were any quarries in this region of Carthia, meaning the rocks would have had to come from some distance away. Veins of a thin ledge ran between the first and second floor. I counted nearly 20 windows just in the front of the house. The orphanage and car char didn't have a single window. Connor stood and gestured toward the estate.
Welcome to my home, boys. I call it Farthenwood. It was my father's home and the home of my childhood. I know its every secret, and dearly love to come here whenever I can get away from the king's business in Driliad. This will be your home as well for the next 2 weeks. I have arranged everything in advance of our arrival. I'm sure you have many questions, but we have other business first.
A line of servants had assembled in front of the wagon. A few quickly took control of the horses and one helped Connor out of the wagon, bowing to him afterward as if he were a royal. Cregan gestured to us to leave the wagon, and when we did, Connor presented us each with a servant.
Follow your man to a warm bath and a change of clean clothes.
He cast an eye on me.
Some of you require more scrubbing than usual, so stay in the bath as long as you must. Once you are presentable, you may join me for a hot supper that I suspect will be the finest meal any of you have ever eaten.
Rodin and Tobias followed their servants into the estate. I followed mine behind them as we entered Farthenwood. The entry was massive and well lit by windows and a large chandelier directly above us. The plaster walls were decorated with beautiful murals of countryside scenes. A tapestry hanging near me depicted dozens of names and faces, probably Connor's family tree.
What's your name?
I asked the servant. He hesitated at first, as if he wasn't sure whether he should answer, and then said,
Errol, sir.
Errol looked like the kind of young man who might never grow enough facial hair to actually require a shave. He had boyish features and a bit of curl in his light blonde hair. I suspected that if the fables about the existence of elves were true, Errol would turn out to be one of them.
I'm Sage. My companions on this trip will assure you I am no sir. Connor seems to think he owns me too, which makes me a servant much like you. So let's keep everything on a first-name basis.
Forgive me, but I've been instructed to call you sir, Errol said, so you should get used to hearing it. I tugged on the rag that served as my shirt. My entire fist could easily have fit through a tear in the fabric near my hip. With me dressed this way,
How can you call me that without laughing? Errol glanced sideways at me and smiled crookedly.
It isn't easy, sir.
When I asked, Errol told me that the rooms off to the left were for a few of the choice servants, such as Mott and Cregan. They also housed a kitchen and other work areas. To the right were rooms for other servants, which several of them shared. I figured Errol's was one of those rooms. A grand staircase rose up from the center of the entry. It was lined with tall beeswax candles and was carpeted in a weave so fine I bent down and ran my fingers over it. Ahead of me, I heard Rodin's servant tell Rodin that with my dirty hands, he'd have to scrub that area of carpet now. Out of spite, I made sure I left a mark there. The second floor consisted of rooms on alternating sides of a long hallway.
I think several of my orphanages could fit in here, Rodin said.
Connor's a rich man, that's for sure, Tobias added. Why does he need so many rooms? I asked. Errol smiled.
If he had fewer rooms, there wouldn't be enough cleaning for all of us to do.
I laughed loudly, which earned a glare from the other two servants. In a quieter voice, Errol continued.
Master Connor often has guests. He wishes to impress his wealth upon them, and usually does.
He said he's a regent in the court. Has the king ever been here?
The king has not, but the queen came once when traveling with her courtiers.
I've heard she's not very pretty, I said. Errol looked at me like I'd slapped him.
Whoever told you that was lying,
he said, as if personally offended.
Queen Erin is a strikingly beautiful woman. Master Connor himself has often commented on that.
Is Connor married?
No, sir. He loved a woman once, but that didn't work out.
Do you know why we've been brought here? I asked. Connor said he has a plan.
If I knew, it wouldn't be my place to say it.
Errol's eyes darted around as he spoke. You don't have to tell me, I said quickly. The last thing I wanted was to make Errol afraid to talk to me. I was just curious.
All we hear as servants are rumors and bits of the whole story, Errol said. You couldn't trust the little I know anyway.
No, I agreed, then changed the subject. How long have you served Connor?
I came here when I was 10, sir, half my life ago.
So he wasn't much older than me, and yet he addressed me as sir. Are you working off a debt to him?
My family's debts. Perhaps another 10 years, then I'll be free to go.
Do you like it here? Errol nodded.
If you do what Connor wants, he's a good master.
What if you don't do what he wants?
Connor sent a messenger ahead.
I heard about you. Errol smiled and added,
I fear you may find out the answer to that question for yourself.
That made me smile as well. You won't get any more trouble from me. It's becoming very clear what happens to those who cross him.
Yes, sir.
Errol stopped at a door.
You'll share a bedroom with the other boys, but your bath will be in here.
He opened the door to reveal a nice-sized room that looked as if it had been converted for use in bathing. The decorations here were soft and feminine, but it didn't appear to be anyone's current living quarters, so I assumed this was a guest room. I was tempted to throw myself down on the bed near a far wall for a nap, but given how dirty I was, they'd probably have to burn the bed afterward. Errol tugged at my shirt to prompt me to undress for the bath, but I jumped away from him and said, I bathe in private. Errol smiled again.
If you will pardon the observation, sir, it doesn't appear that you bathe at all.
I laughed. Well, I won't start by having my bath with company.
My instructions are to bring you to supper as clean as a nobleman's son. I'll wait outside if you wish, but when you come out, if you are not that clean, we'll return to that bath again. I obey the master's wishes, not yours.
This time Errol was not smiling as he closed the door. You can relax out there, I called to him. I'll be a while.
I looked for a way to lock the door but found none, so I dragged a heavy chair to the door and braced it beneath the door handle. The room had a window balcony at the back of the house. I tiptoed out onto it and looked around. A gardener was working below me, but his head was bent down to the flowers.
Probably not a great risk of him looking up.
The exterior of Connor's home was built from rock, with a thin ledge marking each floor. It was a long fall to the ground, but there were a lot of ways to make sure I didn't fall. I swung my body onto the balustrade, balancing myself against the outside wall. Bracing my foot against the angled curve of a rock, I dug my fingers into the crevice of another rock and climbed.